Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, hello. A very warm welcome to Tech Talk, your regular source of accessible technology interviews and reviews that we hope you can use. And I'm Dave Williams. Don't forget, of course, Tech Talk, it's your program. So if you've got something you'd like to share from the world of technology, whether it's a question, comment, tip, or something else, you can get in touch. Our email address, as always, it's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Coming up this time on Tech Talk, we'll be speaking with a design student who has a unique idea for accessible tactile watches. We'll hear about the technology history of one of our listeners whose site changed quite recently, and we'll be hearing also from RNIB's user experience team about some research they are doing into accessible cash machines. So stay tuned for another episode of Tech Talk. Welcome into our co-hosts, Tasneem Arshad and Callum Stoneman. Hello to you both. Callum, what's grabbing your attention this week?
I'm very good, thanks. Looking forward to hearing more about the accessible watches. I am quite into my watches, so looking forward to hearing this.
Yeah, we'll certainly be chatting about that a little bit later. How about you, Tasneem?
I'm really looking forward to hearing and learning more about the cash machine accessibility, because for me personally, I've always used the cash machines with sighted assistance and never independently. So it'd be brilliant to know what accessibility does exist and how effective it is, or what solutions are out there, or what RNIB is actually planning to do.
Thanks very much to you both. So stay tuned. It's Tech Talk.
There are many accessible ways to tell the time, more modern options being your smartphone or your smart speaker. And we've also had talking watches and tactile watches for years. But Absar Ahmed thinks he can improve that. And Tasneem recently called up with him to hear more about his idea.
Well, I'm curious to know your background in product design and if you could summarise your journey into accessibility, particularly in relation to sight loss.
Yeah, sure. So I'll give a brief introduction to myself and for the listeners. So my name's Absar. I'm a 3D designer, currently sort of doing a master's in product design at Kingston University. I done my undergraduate project. I was doing some of the things that I've made was, you know, furniture. I've stemmed from doing furniture to products. And I sort of had to roam around a bit with my sort of imagination, and I ended up, for my final major project, I ended up making a smart insole, and it was like an insole which I 3D printed. It had pressure distribution sensors built in, and that was, you know, for athletes. It was a very niche market which I was sort of trying to delve into. I ended up getting a first class for that project, which was really exciting. So now I'm sort of doing my master's at the moment. We were looking at what sort of themes in relation to my project. And I was looking at form versus function. And yeah, so I'm working on a project which is all about form and function. And I sort of decided to make a tactile watch for those who've experienced sight loss or are also like visually impaired as well. So I was doing lots of research on how people sort of tell the time using their fingertips. And it was a really interesting project and the journey that I've sort of gone through. I found out a lot of information which has helped me as a designer. I've got a friend of mine who I've actually, I used to go to school with him. His name's Solomon Barr. He's a para sprinter. He's a member of the Great British Paralympic team. He's also a motivational speaker, so that's a good thing. So he was actually born with retinitis pigmentosa. So that's an eye condition, you know, progressive loss of vision. He can't see out of his right eye, and he has like very partial vision in his left. So the way he used to describe it to us when we were kids, he used to close his right eye. So he used to put his hand over his right eye, and he used to make a very small pinhole with his left. And he used to say, yeah, I've basically got no peripheral. And that sort of, you know, put things into perspective. And I reached out to him about the project, and he was like, man, this is great stuff, because he was telling me the whole thing about talking watches and how, you know, they can be very cumbersome. They can be, you know, embarrassing when you're using it in public. You know, you're like in the middle of a crowded place, and you press a button and it says, you know, the time is 17:03, like really loudly. And, you know, it can, I get what he says when he's saying he can feel embarrassed at times. And I sort of wanted to eradicate that by making something very discreet, something that you can, you know, just quickly sort of use your fingertips to tell the time and then, you know, get on with your day.
That sounds really interesting. So you have obviously have some knowledge around sight loss, and you have a friend with sight loss, so you've got some knowledge and expertise around that. And I'm wondering, what did you have in mind for the product design? Can you give us more information about that?
It comes with different straps. So one of the things about my design, which I believe is like one of the most like fundamental things, it's all about customization, and you know, it's really part of your identity. See, I love my fashion, I love my accessories, and it's a part of who I am. And you know, certain outfits go with certain accessories, and I don't want people to think that, you know, if you experience sight loss or if you're visually impaired, that you can't be fashionable, because that's just not true. So I wanted something to design, something that people can enjoy wearing, and they see it like, you know, it's an accessory, it's a statement piece. So I've been playing around with the designs of the dials and, you know, what's the most efficient way I can make this work. At the moment, there's this one mechanism which is really easy to use, really simple, which sort of stuck out to me. If I can describe it, it would be almost like just a regular traditional wristwatch, but there's two dials inside the case. So there's an inner dial and there's an outer dial. What they do have is like small sort of bearings, like kind of like braille, like protruding out. You can feel it with your fingertips, and it rotates. So what happens is the outer dial will specify, you know, the minutes. So it will, you know, travel around 60 minutes. And then the hours will obviously go all the way around as well, which is going to be on the inside.
So is this marked in Braille or not? Because it's a tactile watch then.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have anything on the face itself. It's just little two dots which go around in circles, and then there's going to be obviously markings where the 12 o'clock is, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and 9. I'm still working on the design, the different faces which is going to be sort of available. What I'm working on at the moment is different iterations, and once I get them sort of 3D printed, I'm going to go in and talk to people at the RNIB shop, take my work with me, and then I'll have them sort of look at it and tell me what direction would be better.
Yeah, sounds really interesting, actually. And it's always great to get feedback from people with sight loss.
Yeah, so what I done was I got in touch with the RNIB Facebook group, and they put my details on the page. And a lot of people actually reached out, which was great. So some people said, you know, the talking watch thing, you know, it's not always the best having, you know, a talking watch when you're in a crowded space. There's a feature on the Apple Watch, which I found really interesting. It's called Taptic Time. And what it does is it sort of vibrate, little micro vibrations as such sort of play out onto your wrist, and it allows you to tell the time from there. And I've done some research. I own an Apple Watch myself, and I tried the features, but it wasn't really the most efficient thing. So I was just waiting there. It was 9:30 p.m. I was just waiting there, and I was trying to figure out with the vibration. There was like one long vibration, two short vibrations, and then like a slight pause, and then a couple more vibrations. I just couldn't work out what the time was. And I got some feedback from a lovely lady called Anna, who was telling me how the vibrations sometimes, you know, some people might think it's great, it's the best feature, but some people, you know, who experience other things such as, you know, like learning disabilities or people who have, you know, very low amounts of concentration as such, like they might find it extremely difficult to tell the time with vibrations. So I thought, you know, what would be the most appropriate choice would be something as very basic as just using your fingertips to tell where those dials are positioned.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's great. As long as you don't have any difficulties with your hands, that would work really well. I guess that would be a kind of limitation, you know, for people who have difficulties with their hands. What limitations do you think your product has?
When I'm looking at the sort of limitations in my project, I haven't fully sort of gone through everything, but I think one of the most important aspects is things like making sure it's, you know, waterproof, making sure it's durable. Another thing I was sort of looking at was, what if it's winter? What if you're wearing gloves? Would you still be able to feel those dials rotating? So what I'm going to do is, once I make that first sort of working prototype, I'm going to make sure I get a lot of user testing, and that will really tell you what your limitations are. As a designer, you can't just sort of pounce on the limitations when you haven't, you know, actually made it yet. So the first iterations, obviously, when it comes down to design, you need to come up with these first initial sort of models and prototypes, and that's where your final design comes. This isn't a final design right now. This is just sort of something in the works. It's going to get better. It's going to get better. And then once I feel like it's ready, that's when you go on and then say, this is my final design. This is what I'm going to make. At the moment, I've made my second prototype. So the third one is going to be casted in stainless steel. And then from then onwards, I'm going to be working with different strap configurations. Another thing I wanted to mention was, there's a lack of, you know, customization when it comes to watches such as these. And my watch will be sort of highly customizable. It's going to come in a range of different colors and finishes, and it's also going to be very lightweight and comfortable, which is, again, another positive thing.
Yeah, it all sounds really, really interesting and really good. I'm wondering, who's your main target at? So is it mainly targeted at men, women, unisex?
It's going to be unisex. However, there's going to be different color options you can choose. So, you know, for example, if you're a woman and you wanted a rose gold one, that would be available. And if you wanted, you know, something that's, you know, gunmetal gray, for example, that's also going to be there. So, like I said, it's open to a lot of choices in terms of color and range. It will probably also come in different sizes. For example, if you've got smaller wrists, there'll be a smaller case, for example, like 36 mil. And if you're a bigger sort of person, you can get one in, you know, 40, 42 or 45 mil. So yeah, I don't think there is a specific target like in mind, but all I know is it's definitely not one size fits all, but I reckon it's very customizable. So it will be sort of open for everyone.
I don't personally wear a wristwatch, and I don't like the larger kind of smart watches that are available that I feel are more kind of targeted for chaps. I kind of like the much more sort of smaller, daintier options. The discreet aspect, what I really like and where I can see your product working, is for people who have sight loss, who have meetings and you're away from your computer, or you're kind of, you know, either on the move, or even, you know, in any sort of meetings, whatever capacity you're working in, and you need to check that time discreetly, that would be quite, I could really see you working in that area.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what I ideally wanted is something that will, you know, it doesn't draw that attention towards you, something that you can sort of show off in a way as well. What I wanted to do when it comes to the whole form versus function argument, I wanted this to be functional, yet very aesthetic as well. When you define form, I think the Oxford Dictionary sort of definition is like the visible shape of something, right? So when it comes to the form, that can also refer to the color, the texture, the pattern, you know, all sorts of things. So definitely something that I want to work on to make sure that there's no boxes that are left unticked. And then there's function. Function can be, you know, defined as like a practical use or like a purpose in design. And that sort of refers to the functionality of a product and its ability to like actually give a purpose. Because in my opinion, the function needs a form in order to, you know, accomplish its aesthetic appeal. Because without form, function is just an impractical object for like, yeah, it's not really going to work, is it? And as a designer myself, I consider both to play like an equally important role. And obviously in the creation of my product, like the whole project that I'm working on expresses my views in a lot more detail.
I really love that. I think that when one goes out to buy clothing, for example, well, certainly speaking for myself, you know, I'm always looking for that glamour, that sparkle, but equally I want it to be functional and practical as well. And it's quite hard to find that combination. So I think that having that in a practical, timeless watch piece would be amazing. If people want to give you more feedback on this or learn more about it, where can they find out more information?
My information is all on the RNIB group. I'll send out my email as well. It's absar-ahmed@hotmail.co.uk. So just to spell it, that will be absar-ahmed@hotmail.co.uk. You can drop me an email if you do have any sort of tips or any advice that I'm definitely going to be willing to take on. We are also going to be hosting a design show later on in the year. It's going to be at the Herman Miller London showroom. It's not anytime soon, though. It's going to be in October. So the dates is Tuesday, 18th of October to Thursday, the 20th of October. It's free to sort of come in and attend. So if you guys do want to come and check it out, it's going to be at the exhibition there. So there's going to be two events. There's going to be an evening event, which is on Tuesday. It's going to be 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. And then the day event is on the Wednesday, which is 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. And obviously after that, obviously we'll continue. So yeah, it will be great to come by.
Okay. And finally, I wanted to ask, when is the prototype going to be fully ready by, do you think?
In terms of time scale, I'm working to get it ready by sort of the exhibition, definitely, so people can use it and tell me how they feel. So that's going to be hopefully by October.
Sounds really good. We're really looking forward to watching this space and learning more and seeing how you get on with it.
Thank you, Tasneem. Yeah.
Watch out, Callum Stoneman's here. I'm hoping you've got time to talk about this. Callum, do you use an accessible watch first and foremost?
Two puns in one go. Nice one. yeah, I mean, I've got the Apple Watch, and obviously that talks. And then I've got the Bradley watch as well, which is a really nice kind of tactile watch. And that's kind of my special occasion watch. You know, it's quite fancy.
Right. So let's just sort of unpack this a little bit. So there are, of course, easy to see watches, and RNIB has a range of those. And then there are standalone talking watches. I always find the voices on some of those standalone talking watches are a little bit problematic. And of course, the other issue is it's not very discreet, is it?
Yeah, you see, that's one thing that I like about the Apple Watch. You know, it does talk, but it's using voiceover. So you've got the flexibility there. You know, you can change the volume and you can change the speed. So it doesn't really shout out. You know, if I tap my watch now, it would say, you know, it might say like 1300 hours, but it says it quite fast and quite quietly. So you don't really notice it. Whereas, yeah, when I was younger, I went through a whole load of talking watches and, you know, they were good. They were really good. They got the job done. They told me the time, but they also told everyone else the time two streets away. Not the best.
Well, and you get that horrible chime sometimes. It's 4:35 a.m.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not what you need. And the other thing you can do, so Apple Watch is obviously a little bit more expensive and it is more than just a watch. I mean, we've talked about, you know, the fitness features and, you know, the fact that you can put music on there and all that kind of stuff. And it does cost a little bit more. It's a bit more affordable than it used to be. I think the entry level Apple Watch now is like 200 quid, which is still, you know, a significant investment. But hopefully, if it's something that you're going to have for many years and it makes a big difference to your life in terms of all the other features and functions that it has available, then maybe it is worth it. I use the haptic time feature on Apple Watch. I don't know if you've tried this, where you can you switch it on in settings, and then when you want to know the time, you can perform I think it's a single finger double tap, and then it will vibrate to sort of pulse out the hours. So it does a long tap for a 5 and then a short tap, long tap for a 10, I think, and then a short tap for each of the units, you know. So you get a very discreet indicator of what the time is. So for me, there's definitely still a role for having some kind of tactile or haptic element in a watch, because sometimes I just don't want any spoken output.
Yeah, exactly the same for me. And I mainly use the haptic time on a night. You know, if I wake up in the middle of the night and I want to check the time, because I remember when me and my wife now, but when me and my girlfriend first got together, we I had a talking watch then, not an Apple Watch, just one of the standard ones, and I think I've basically been banned from talking watches, because every time I woke up in the middle of the night shouting out, you know, as you said before, it's 4 a.m. waking everyone else up. Yeah, not great.
Are you saying that your girlfriend said she would leave you unless you got a new watch?
Pretty much, yeah. I think it did get to that point eventually.
Crikey. Right. And then, of course, with tactile watches, the sort of the classic tactile watch would have like a hinged lid. You press a button and it would release the lid, and then that would sort of open on a hinge. And then you put your fingers inside and you'd be able to feel the fingers. And of course, they were specially designed, so you didn't push the fingers around the time as the, you know, to actually alter the time. So those watches, my issue with them was that they were never particularly rugged. You know, and eventually what would happen is that the clasp would weaken, and so the kind of spring-loaded hinge would pop open on its own, and you wouldn't realise, and then you catch the lid on the edge of a door frame. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, I had a couple of those kind of standalone tactile watches, but the issue for me was that, and I don't know if this actually is the case, or if, you know, it felt to me really weird. It felt weird, the thought of sat there and opening up your watch. That just felt like a strange thing for me. It's obviously not a normal thing to do. Whereas the Bradley watch, which is the other one that I've got, as I mentioned earlier, that's a bit different because it's all exposed. So the actual watch itself, it doesn't have glass over the face. It's just, you know, the face of the watch is the tactile markings. And then there's these little ball bearings that move around to indicate the time. And that's, you know, it's designed to be that way, so you can't knock it easily. But they've managed to design that in such a way that the tactile side of it is just open and exposed, but it looks, you know, or so I'm told, it looks normal. In fact, it looks really, really, you know, stylish and different, but in a good way, apparently.
Yeah, I managed to pick one up on eBay, actually. Got a really good price on a Bradley. And I think it's shaped a little bit like a Jammy Dodger. If you imagine a Jammy Dodger, which is sort of like a sandwich of sort of two layers, and then there's a groove around the outer edge, and in that groove sits a ball bearing, which I think gives you the time. And then there's another ball bearing on the top in that sort of central sort of circular section. So one of them is used for the hours and the other one is used for the minutes. As much as I like it, and as much as I get compliments about, I tend not to use it very much, though. So it's sitting in its box there and probably needs a new battery as well. But again, you know, sort of a silent way of checking the time as well. Well, let us know what kind of accessible watch you prefer and why. You can drop us a line, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Callum Stoneman, thanks very much. Dovrick Lewis Smith is a legal professional who has recently experienced significant changes to his eyesight. However, he's leaned into accessible technology, which is making all the difference in his life. We hear from Dovrick now.
So my name's Dovrick Lewis Smith. I'm a solicitor based in Salford and I work in local government. I use a variety of tech. I use JAWS for my work access. I use a Mac and iPhone for my own use using VoiceOver. I also use various scanning equipment such as ClearView and things like InVision and the VoiceStream Reader on the iPhone. I also use a variety of Braille technology ranging from very, very basic stuff like slates and stylus for making my own notes and bump-ons on things I need to reach, to using a Brailliant BIX20, which is the one where you can plug into Bookshare and get stuff off that, and also, you know, plug it into your computer as a readout screen, or just generate stuff straight into Braille on the machine. So that's where I'm at up to at the moment.
You're right across the piece there, Dovrick, in terms of all the tools.
Yep.
Do I take it then, you mentioned Braille, are you totally blind yourself?
Yes, I went blind about 5 years ago. So because I knew that I was going blind, the suggestion of Catherine, my wife, I learnt Braille. So I got got a course out of the RNIB. I think it was called Fingertips or Fingerprint.
Fingerprint,
and
yeah.
That's the one. And because I had quite a long journey to and from London at the time when we were living in Cambridge, I was able to crack through that in about a month and a half, which was, you know, quite a thing at the time to go from a standing start to this highly technical code. But since then, I just love Braille. I couldn't do without it because I'm constantly reading things, and to not be able to read things would have been a great loss. So, you know, if anybody out there is listening to this, learn Braille because it's good for you.
That must be some sort of record, 6 weeks to get through Fingerprint. Congratulations. How did you find the journey into Braille technology then? Because Fingerprint is about reading Braille, usually from paper. So what was your journey into Braille technology like? How, you know, what was your first Braille display? Where did you find Braille displays?
My first Braille display was the Orbit. So, listening to Tech Talk when I first started going completely blind and hearing about the Orbit and what it was possible. So I got the Orbit when the original one, which was about £400. And so it was good to be able to afford something like that. And finding that was a possible way in. My Orbit conked out, sadly out of warranty, and before I know the RNAB have now set up a dedicated service to help support with repairs and the like, but whilst looking at alternatives after the Orbit died, I came across the Brailliant, which because of the variety of things it could offer above and beyond the Orbit, and obviously you pay for that. The Orbit is absolutely fantastic as an entry level thing, and I'm not knocking it at all. It's a great machine to get you into at an affordable price. But I found the Brailliant, which the new BIX series was doing the things I wanted to do, including a much easier way of creating my own documents on it if I wanted to. It's slightly more intuitive in terms of navigation, and also because I have language abilities beyond English, the ability to change quickly between Braille codes was also quite a draw to me as well. And also the upcoming fact that they're hopefully going to get the text to speech rolled out on that soon as well. Means that's a machine that's doing a lot of the things I wanted to do.
So for you, Braille was very much about precision, being able to work in a kind of a multilingual way,
yep.
And obviously just the joy of being able to read for yourself rather than be read to. Screen reading then, so it's quite kind of a change of mindset to go from being able to see text on a display yourself to pressing buttons and having a screen reader speak to you and also navigate around the screen from the keyboard rather than using a mouse. I often say when you use a web page, for example, with a screen reader, it's a bit like sucking the internet through a straw. You know, you've got a very linear kind of narrow stream of information with speech and you know, Braille does help with that. But when you land on a page and there are hundreds of links and headings and lists and tables and forms and all the other elements that go along with that, I mean, did you get training or how did you learn to use a screen reader?
Well, I could see I used Zoom Text. And when I got reassessed for access to work when my site was changing, they suggest I get onto Fusion, and I started using Fusion, so it allowed me to do a combination of magnification and the speech out of that. And they got me one of the Optolec clear views that had the OCR in it, and using that to read documents out to me as well, which was a great help. So I started transitioning, and then the actual sight loss came at a it came in one go. There was it suddenly was there and then it wasn't, and so I'm suddenly having to just do things. Now I just managed to get enough of a head start with OCR and Fusion, and then they got me the full JAWS package, and because I had some knowledge of how VoiceOver worked on an iPhone, I could get the concept, but I didn't get training with JAWS. I kind of just threw myself into it and saw what happened, and because I know JAWS can be quite a complicated machine, so it's been a bit rough, but I think I'm kind of getting the hang of it. And now that Vespero are putting out a lot more of their information on various podcasts and on YouTube, just finding the focused pieces of information I want in order to do my job. And I think there's also been a step up in the last 3 or 4 years, it seems to me. Things like PDFs and navigation have suddenly become a lot easier to navigate. When I first started, PDF were just an absolute nightmare. But now I'm fortunate that I'm on JAWS 2022 on my work machine. And what this means is that I have access to the facilities that do the OCR of the PDF and can convert it into a Word document. There's a little bit more navigational stuff that they've been introducing. So both I and JAWS have changed over the years. So I think I'm getting to a place where it is a good system. I mean, there are things I think VoiceOver does that JAWS doesn't, which I wish it did. But then, of course, there are things that VoiceOver doesn't do, like work most of the time on a Mac. So, you know, there's swings and roundabouts with it.
Of course, document accessibility also depends, you know, relies very heavily on the author and how that document is produced. Let's talk about touch screens then. Many blind and partially sighted people really struggle with those at the start, and I know that I did. It's I think 11 years or maybe slightly longer since I got my first iPhone, and I did wonder on that first day, how long will I stick with this? You know, just the whole notion of here we have a flat piece of glass that's completely featureless and smooth, and you've got to use the screen reader and learn to use a series of gestures that may not seem completely intuitive at first to get to grips with the system. You mentioned that you are a VoiceOver user on iPhone. How did you get going with that?
The issue for me is that I'd been using the iPhone quite a lot when I had sight, so I'd already learned how to use it essentially. So when I went completely blind, it was a question of just using gestures I already knew and just learning how to manage that, just learning a new additional skill of listening. What's interesting is that I came late to VoiceOver, and I look back now and I think my life would have been a lot easier even when I could see with the most sight I had. My life would have been a lot easier with knowledge of the VoiceOver functions, with knowledge of what could be done, that I didn't have to do it entirely by sight. But I think that's a psychological thing that a lot of partially sighted people have, in that they want to use their sight, and we sometimes don't think beyond that.
Do you think there's a sense that for partially sighted people, even using a screen reader a little bit feels a bit like an admission of defeat in a way, and so they struggle on trying to see the screen when actually a little bit of speech might be helpful?
Yes, I think there is that. I know there were points in my life where I'm thinking, I want to be able to read this. And so I would struggle with a document, especially a document I had to read at work, and then I had to produce a report on it. I look back and I think, why did I do that? Because, now that I've got my JAWS set up and I'm using an Eloquence voice, which you can speed up to goodness knows how fast, and I'm looking at some of these documents, which used to take me couple of days to work through, and I can do it in half a day now. And I'm thinking, you idiot, frankly. You know, this stuff was there. But I guess it's about knowledge. If you don't really know that stuff's out there, so for example, I didn't really fully appreciate how powerful a tool VoiceOver was on an iPhone till 2014, 2015, and it'd been already knocking around for 5 or 6 years. And so it's interesting how the stuff was always there, but the knowledge wasn't there to allow you to make better use of it.
And how about the systems at work? You mentioned that your background is in legal and local government. Do you find those systems at work are largely accessible or inaccessible? Do you make use of a support worker? How much self-advocacy do you need to do in the workplace to get access to information?
I've never had a support worker because the systems have always been accessible, and I've always had very, very supportive people around me in terms of, I say, I need this, and it gets done. Now, sometimes that falls under the cracks. There's some sort of internal systemic things that things don't happen. But I've never been left unable to do my job, and we've always found ways of working around. I mean, there have been some challenges. I mean, there are IT things, changes going on at my place of work at the moment, where there are things that need to be thought about in slightly different ways. It's mostly around, does the system work in general, rather than is this system accessible? Because most of our problems are things that affect other people as well. Once I can get in to the file or the folder area where I need to be, the actual tech that I've got in terms of support has worked really well. And like I say, I've always had colleagues who are willing to say, if you can't read it, let me know and we'll put it in some other format. Or got very, very good admin support here where I say, I have no idea whether these changes have actually caused chaos to the formatting of this document. Can you tidy it up for me, please? Which is what colleagues are for. So, they're all really, really helpful in that regard.
So did you manage to stay in the same job then as your eyesight changed, or did you move to a new role?
My eyesight started to change whilst I was working for the Law Society in London. And it was remaining relatively stable when we moved up here to Salford. But I went blind after I'd started here. I was very open when I first came up and we were having the assessments of what I need. We were having that initial conversation early 2016 and saying, come 2017, 2018, my situation may well be different. And my immediate line managers and more senior people have been incredibly supportive in terms of, just get what you need and we'll pay for it. That's an advantage, I guess, of working in the local government sector. People just cause it to happen. And that's worked out really well. I'm also conscious that my disability, in a sense, is much easier to understand than somebody with a mobility disability or anything that isn't obvious. My problem is I can't see. So we just get the fixes to mean that I can access the documents I need to do. And people knew that I could do the job. So it wasn't a problem. So I've been very, very fortunate in that regard.
You are clearly a very resilient individual, very determined. Not many people learn Braille in 6 weeks. And a lot of people really struggle, actually, to get started with screen readers. So you're quite unusual. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. What do you think is the biggest barrier that people losing eyesight face? Do you think it's access to information or attitudinal?
I think it's more the access to informational side. I think for me, the struggle is, where do I find the information I need? If I draw an analogy, when I was at university, there would be posters for all sorts of things on notice boards and plastered across the campus. But I could never access those, even if there were things that would have interested me at the time, just simply didn't know they were there, couldn't get that information. And I think that's a thing that is notable. Using some of the tech is quite hard because the user guides are designed essentially by techie people, and they don't really start from a position of, you won't necessarily understand what I mean when I say file or run or whatever. And I think that's a challenge. On the sort of personal level, I am the sort of person is, once I know what the question is, I can start looking for an answer. But often you don't know what the question is. And there's that gap between what is the question and where's the information. I think more could be done in terms of presenting information in ways that people can both access and comprehend more easily. Because I do think there's a gap between the people who write these guides and the people who use them.
So what advice would you have for blind and partially sighted people who may be losing significant amounts of eyesight, who are really struggling to realise the benefits of technology? And also, what advice would you have for the industry and those responsible for developing products on which people like you and I rely on a daily basis?
For people coming to terms with their changes in their lives, there are places you can get information. There's an excellent RNIB technology-based podcast, and there are other products out there as well on that basis, on that score. There's plenty of places where people are talking about the tech that's available and what you can achieve with them. So there is the information out there. Obviously, that kind of relies on you being able to access the internet in the first place, which I know is not necessarily easy for lots of people. So I think if somebody who is not very tech savvy, do get in touch with places like the RNIB to start talking about, you know, how do I even switch this phone on? How do I even get onto the internet in the first place? One of the things I do as a lawyer is I look at drafting of letters. You know, we draft letters that go out to our pensioner members. And I think, how would I feel as a person who is not as articulate as the person who's written this letter? If I receive this, what does it mean? What's the really important information? So I make a point of trying to both simplify the language and structure a letter saying, no, this is the reason why we're writing to you and we're going to explain this to you. If there was a more an attitude like that.
What do you do outside of work, Dovrick?
I do quite a few things, not particularly exciting, I'm afraid. I do a bit of creative writing. I play the ukulele. I read far too many books than is sensible. And, you know, I've basically got Audible and the RNIB library through Easy Reader going pretty much all the time.
Well, I wish you all the best in all your endeavours and with the creative writing. You never know, we might get to read some of it at some point. Yeah, indeed. Well, good luck and thanks very much for your time.
No problem at all. Thanks, Dave.
Still to come on Tech Talk, we'll be answering your emails and learning more about accessible cash points.
We've had an email from Kay in Buffalo, New York. Hello, Kay. Great to have you listening. And you commented on our interview with Cobalt and the feedback that they had for the folks at Blindshell. And you were asking if we have covered the Hable 1. I'm not sure we have covered the Hable 1, Callum Stoneman.
No, I don't think we have. It's a great product, though. So it's of course, a Bluetooth Braille keyboard that you can use to type and also control your phone, and it's kind of pocket sized, isn't it?
It is indeed, yeah. So we need to put that right, Kay. Great shout, and we will look into doing something about Hable 1 on a future show. And thanks for listening, and don't forget to tell all your friends.
It feels like contactless payments are everywhere nowadays. Every retailer seems to be accepting card payments and contactless payments and Apple Pay, but cash hasn't completely disappeared. We do still need to get cash out every now and again. And of course, the challenge for us is the accessibility of those machines. Sabine Croxford joins us now, and she's a user experience evaluator at RNIB, who are currently running a survey on accessible cash machines. Here she is next to tell us more.
For many years, RNIB has been committed to access to personal finance for blind and partially sighted people. And one of the key elements of that commitment is access to cash machines, or as they're called in the industry, ATMs. And joining me now is Sabine Croxford, who is a user experience evaluator with RNIB. Welcome to Tech Talk, Sabine. Thank you so much for joining us. Just for someone who has never used one, what accessibility features can we typically expect as blind and partially sighted people?
Thank you very much, Dave. Yes, with regard to cash points or ATMs, there's certain things that we can look at. And with regards to accessibility, obviously for people who can still see something, clear visual design is very important. So we look at the contrast on the screen and the font size, for example. Do need to realize that there are some limitations that the banks have with regards to font size, because obviously the screen is a certain size, so you can't make the font as big as you might like, or you might do on your own personal device, because you're limited to the screen size that's available and sort of the number of options that would need to be displayed on the screen as well. So when we're working with banks, we always stress the importance of clear visual design, and because this obviously benefits many people who just walk up to the ATM and want to use it with sight. For people who don't have enough residual vision to access the information on the screen, there is often the option to use speech as well. And the speech is generally activated when you plug in your headphones. So these are your standard headphones with a standard headphone jack. So not your Bluetooth or wireless headphones, but just your standard old-fashioned one with a cable. The headphone socket is often tactile, so you can feel it. And obviously, if you're familiar with the machine, then you would know where it is. It's often located near the card slot on the right, but it can also be located right at the front. There's often, you can feel the head socket, it's tactile, or there's a tactile symbol on there as well. So if you're not familiar with the ATM, then it might be useful to go either into the branch and ask a member of staff to help you, and they can tell you where the headphone socket is. And you can also try it out in the branch, and you might feel more secure to do that with somebody there. Or there might be somebody with you that can help you find the headphone sockets, especially the first time that you want to use the machine. And once you've plugged in your headphones, the audio instructions will start to talk and it will tell you what to do next.
Okay. And important to emphasize that it is those classic headphones with a 3.5mm jack on the end. Your lightning earphones or Bluetooth earphones, they're not going to work. You need the regular traditional headphones.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. So for talking cash machines in particular, then, just sort of walk us through, once you've plugged in your headphones and you get those instructions, it works slightly differently, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So when you're using an ATM with speech, the buttons next to the screens, they're not used, because with sight, you tend to look at the screen. There's different options on the screen and you select the button next to the option that you want. But obviously, if you can't see the screen, then that is not accessible to you. So it's much easier to then use the standard pin pads, which has a standard telephone layout with 1, 2, 3 at the top and a pip on the number 5. So most people are familiar with that layout and they're able to find the different digits and numbers on that keypad. And then next to that keypad, there are the function buttons as well. So you've got the cancel, clear and enter buttons that have got tactile symbols on there as well to help identify them. So you've got a tactile cross or an X for the cancel button, a sort of vertical line or a chevron for the clear button, and a circle for the enter button at the bottom right. So by using that keypad, you can enter the digits and the numbers that you want for the options that you select. So when you plug in your headphones, the instructions will tell you what to do. It might say you have to press the 5 button with the pip to actually start the transaction with speech. And then it will actually ask you questions. So it's a little bit like the options you would get if you call a business, for example, or your GP for an appointment, and it gives you the various options over the phone, and you have to press a certain number to go to a certain person or a certain department. So the ATM will ask you similar questions. So it will ask you what service do you require, for example, and it gives you various options. So it would say for cash, press 1, for balance, press 2, to change your PIN, press 3, etc. So when you then press the number you require, then you go to the next page and a similar thing happens again. So if you selected that you wanted cash, for example, it would say for £10, press 1, for £20, press 2, for £50, press 3, for £100, press 4, and for any other amount, press 8, for example. So we have tested this with quite a few blind and partially sighted people over the years, and it works really quite well. It's quite straightforward. And we've also had people who don't normally use speech really liking this, because they often struggle to see the screen and need to get really close to the screen in order to see it, and feel maybe quite uncomfortable doing this because they might be up on the street and they don't want to sort of draw attention to themselves. But if you've got a headphone in one ear, then people are quite comfortable doing this.
So why do you think, Sabine, why are these features so important, particularly the speech output? Why not just grab somebody off the street to give you a hand? Why do you think it's so important for blind people in particular to have speech output on cash machines?
I think in general for anybody, if you want cash, that you be able to withdraw money from your own account independently, or to be able to check your balance independently, is key. You don't want to ask somebody else to help you with that. We've heard stories from people who need cash and they need to ask the taxi driver to enter their PIN into a cash machine, for example. And I think that is totally unacceptable, obviously. And people still need cash. You need cash sometimes for paying for taxis. Some taxis don't accept debit cards. Some people do shopping for their neighbors, for example. They want to, or have their shop done by neighbors. They want to pay for cash if you go to a car boot sale or anything like that. So cash is still around, and it's a service that is available to anybody. So should always and also be accessible and available to blind and partially sighted people.
Excellent. And we have had these talking machines for quite some time now, about 10 years, as far as I can remember. RNIB's got a survey, though. So we're just kind of checking in and finding out what's happening. Tell us a bit more about the survey.
Yeah, so we've been told by some people recently that they do not have access, or they don't have any talking cash machines near where they live. And what we're trying to find out is a little bit more about this, and whether this is because the ATMs don't talk anymore, so maybe the banks have updated their ATMs and they haven't moved over the talking features to it, or it could be that there are more smaller ATMs installed, like the portable ones that you would have in shops, for example, or petrol stations, that are not linked maybe to the main banks, and they might not be accessible. Or is it that people are not able to find the headphone socket on the ATM? Or is it that they don't know about talking ATMs in the first place? So we're just trying to find out a little bit about it and see what people's experiences are.
Yeah, because this was quite a sort of hard-won thing, because obviously ATMs have been around for quite some time before they started talking. So it felt like a bit of a victory at the time. And obviously if there are reports now of ATMs that perhaps have stopped talking, we don't know, and hence the survey. Who are you hoping to reach with this survey?
Well, I think what we're trying to find out here is quite basic. It's just to find out whether ATMs talk, really. So we're hoping to reach anybody who's willing to help us with that. So anybody that passes an ATM, really. So it could be blind and partially sighted people. Could also be sighted people that want to help. So all you need, really, is some headphones, plug them in and see if the ATM starts to talk.
Okay, and where do people need to be located? Is this just in England, or is this right across the UK?
It's right across the UK. I think many banks sort of go across the UK, so it doesn't really matter where people are located. It's most likely that we get most results from the slightly larger villages, towns and cities. These tend to have more ATMs, but it doesn't really matter where people are located.
Right, and what sorts of information will people need to provide?
Well, we have got a survey with some questions, and that ask about sort of which bank the ATM is, for example, or whether it's located inside or outside a branch or in a shop, for example, or a petrol station or a town or a city. So what we'd like to know is A, if the ATM has a headphone socket, because if it doesn't have a headphone socket, then obviously it won't have speech either that people can activate. And the headphone socket can be located in different places, so it's important to find out if it's got a headphone socket. And then the next step is obviously to find out whether the ATM actually talks, because it might have a headphone socket, but if it hasn't got the software behind it that actually makes the ATM speak, then that's the next thing that we're interested in as well.
Okay, and how long have we got? When does the survey close?
The survey is open for the whole month of August, so till the end of August basically.
Okay, and where do we find it?
Find the survey on the RNIB website. So if you search for testing ATM, for example, you will get a link that says quick action, help people with sight loss by testing ATM machines. And then that will take you to the right page where you can fill in the form. So it's searching on the RNIB website for testing ATM. That's the shortest one I could come up with. And then the first link is quick action, help people with sight loss testing ATMs. And alternatively, you can email our mailbox as well, our email box, and we can forward you a link to the survey as well. And our email is nppd, so N for November, ppd, at rnib.org.uk.
Okay, that's N for November, P for Papa, D for Delta at rnib.org.uk. Sabine, is there anything else you'd like to share at
this
point?
Just like to mention that I work for RNIB, for the user experience team, and we work with external companies on making their products, their websites and their apps more accessible to blind and partially sighted people. And we're always looking for blind and partially sighted people to help us with testing. So website testing is often done remotely via Zoom, especially since the pandemic. But product testing often takes place face-to-face, and that's generally in our Peterborough or our London RNIB office. But we can also travel to a location if we can get a group of people together to test this. And that is obviously only if the product is portable. So, for example, an ATM is not something that we can take with us on the train and take to your location. You would have to come to the bank, for example. But if it's a portable product, then we can potentially go to other places. But generally, the testing takes place in Peterborough or London, where our offices is. And What happens is we ask people to carry out tasks on either the product or the website or the app, as you would normally do. So, for example, a shopping website, we would ask people to browse or find a product that they like, put it in the right size, add it to their basket, and then go through the payment system as well. So if you are talking about a product, for example, like a microwave or a shower, we would ask people how to turn it on, turn it off, adjust the temperature, and all that sort of things that you would normally do with that product. And then we'll watch people and see how they get on, basically. So it's not to test people. It's very much to test the product or the website. We do pay travel expenses, and sometimes there's a shopping voucher as a sort of a thank you for your time and feedback as well. So if you are interested in this, then please do get in touch with us as well. And the email is the same as before, nppd@rnib.org.uk.
That's brilliant. Well, we at Tech Talk are very interested in the work of your team, Sabine. So do stay in touch and let us know the findings of that survey, how it goes. It'd be good to know if there is an issue or perhaps it's just a couple of, you know, isolated things that can be solved. We're really keen to keep tabs on that and anything else that you might be working on. So don't forget, if you'd like to get involved in testing products for their accessibility, that email address one more time. It's N for November, P for Papa, D for Delta@rnib.org.uk. Sabine Croxford, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Callum Stoneman, when did you last use a cash machine?
Do you know what? I can't actually remember. I think it was probably maybe a couple of months ago, but my wife was with me at the time, so I just got sighted help. But it's rare that I use cash machines, and even more rare that I find an accessible one nowadays. There's loads out there that have got the little headphone jack, but you know, you plug it in and nothing happens.
Well, you need to fill in that survey and let RNIB know.
I do.
Yeah, of course, the other way to get cash is cash back. If you buy something in a shop, often you can ask them for, you know, 20 quid. I mean, you know, it comes out your account. They don't just give it you, but it is one way of getting hands-on cash if you need it and you haven't got access to a machine. Or, of course, imagine you could even go in branch
and talk to someone.
Oh, no. But yeah, we do need accessible cash machines. And if you would like to feedback, I would strongly urge you to get in contact with RNIB and fill in that survey before the end of August. We are coming to the end of another Tech Talk. Thank you so much for keeping us company and tuning in. It is about you and we'd love you to be involved. You don't have to be a sort of a radio production expert. I'm not. Just drop us a line, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. You can record a voice note on your phone. You can do it all sorts of ways. My thanks to Callum Stoneman and Tasni Marshad for your company this week. And from myself, Dave Williams, and the rest of the team, bye for now.
See you soon.
Bye for now.